All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
Hello, world, and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry. I was a chief warrant officer during the Vietnam War, 1969. I was a helicopter pilot in that beautiful country. I want to welcome you to our program today. We've got, I think, a great story by a gentleman. His name is Tom Satterley, and he's going to be talking about his book, which is just mind-blowing to me. It's such a great story. It's entitled All Secure, A Special Operations Soldier's Fight to Survive on the Battlefield and the Home Front. You got to stick around for this story. It's a, as I said, it's a great story. It's about a super ultra secret part of our special operations forces that are out there, and the stories are going to make the hair on the back of your neck stand up. And the work he is doing now that he is retired is probably even more important than what he did while he was in the service for 25 years. So stick around when we talk to Tom Satterley. I want to make sure that we thank our sponsors here on Veterans Radio today. Number one is Legal Help for Veterans. They specialize in veterans' disability claims. For more information and a free consultation, you can go to the website, legalhelpforveterans.com, or give them a call at 844-224-2237. That's 844-224-2237 for a free consultation. And U.S. Wings, the manufacturers of the finest leather flight jackets in the world. U.S. Wings is a major supplier of leather flight jackets for the military. And for more information, you can go to their website. That's uswings.com, or give the Sarge a call at 800-650-0659. That's 800-650-0659. And while I'm thinking about it, coming up on our program on March 29th, that'll be our benefits program for the month of March. It's the last Sunday. I got to remind you that U.S. Wings is giving away a U.S. Army, official U.S. Army A2 flight jacket. And these are based on the jackets that the pilots wore back in World War II. And there's a limited number of these that have been issued to the U.S. Army. I'm reading an email I got from a Sarge. It says, the U.S. Army A2 flight jacket is that we've only issued a very small amount of them, and on the 1st of April, only 600 will be issued to the U.S. Army recruiters. And keep in mind that there are approximately 9,000 recruiters on active duty. Then the 82nd Airborne and the 101st Special Ops, Rangers, Special Forces, and all fixed-wing and all helicopter pilots worldwide, plus colonel and above officers, has nothing to do with that. But you have the opportunity to win one of these jackets by going to veteransradio.net and clicking on the picture of the jacket, the A2 jacket, and registering, and we'll have a drawing on our program on March 29th. This jacket is worth a lot of money. I can't tell you the cost, otherwise I have to hurt you. We also want to make sure that we thank all of our local veteran service organizations that have helped us stay on the air here in Ann Arbor for going on 18 years now. Number one would be the VVA, Vietnam Veterans of America, Charles S. Kettle's Chapter 310 here in Ann Arbor. Never again shall a veteran coming home from battle be made to feel alone and unappreciated. VFW Post, number 423. This is a Graft O'Hara post. No one does more for veterans than the VFW. And finally, we have the American Legion here in Ann Arbor. This is the Irwin Prescorn post, number 46. This is Veterans Helping Veterans. And thank goodness we have all these organizations to help veterans out there. And my guest later on in the program is going to be talking about a new organization that he has started up that is out there to help veterans and their families as well. But, well, you know, we've got this coronavirus out there running rampant, it seems like, around the world. And everybody is either staying home or self-quarantining themselves and so forth. But many of us have to go up to the Ann Arbor VA hospital. And so I brought on an expert. My guest is Brian Hayes. He's the director of public relations up there. And Brian, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Thanks, Dale. It's really nice to be back with you to talk about such an important event that's going on with VA and really with the country.
Right. And the reason I asked you to come on the program, and I know that you're only speaking for the Ann Arbor VA and not the, all of them across the country, is what precautions is the Ann Arbor VA taking to protect their employees and their patients?
Well, fortunately, we were ahead of the curve when we started screening at the Ann Arbor VA. We were doing screenings end of the week before last, actually, and started getting a little bit more intense with the screenings last week. So right now, we've had to put in place visitor restrictions. So not only is everyone being screened as they come into the building, they are also putting the visitation restrictions on, so that really, unless you're a patient or an employee at this VA, you will not be permitted into the building. So there's visitors and guests are not allowed on any site of care. That includes all of our community-based outpatient clinics and the medical center. Only patients are admitted. The only exception to that would be for, say, essential caregivers. If you need somebody to help you get around, someone who's providing care, of course that person would be able to come with you. No one under the age of 18 is permitted into the building. Where we can, we're using telecommunications and video conferencing to include family members and medical decision-making for patients that are inpatient. All entrances to the healthcare system are limited. Staff are being screened. We're looking for, the three biggies, right? The fever, mm-hmm. the shortness of breath, and the coughing. And, of course, any patient who comes in who is coughing, looks like they may have any kind of those symptoms, we're masking them and taking them to our emergency department right away.
Okay. So do they still go in the same entrance as normal? Or can they go in the main entrances?
You can. You can go into the main entrance, but we've restricted the hours of the main entrance to 5 a.m. to 7 p.m. So the main entrance is open during the day. It used to be open much later, but we've restricted that time so that we can route people off hours through our emergency department. So you will always have access to the medical center. Mm-hmm. It's just that our front end, because of staffing issues, we have to keep these screenings staffed, and so a lot of people are working a lot of overtime and, trying to make sure that these, everything that needs to be attended to is attended to. So what we like to do is just have everybody come through the emergency department in those off hours. So after 7 p.m. and on the weekends, the front entrance is closed.
Okay, so let's go back and review. So if I go up there for an appointment, I go through the main entrance like I normally do.
You guys
are going to give me a little check.
You're going to get checked out a little bit. Yeah, we haven't started. We may start. It's a very fluid situation, as you know, Dale.
Right.
By tomorrow, we don't know. We're not taking temperatures just yet, but we might start doing that by tomorrow. And really, before you come to your appointment, we would kind of like you to check in, with your clinic to make sure that it's okay. So we're really asking veterans to just give your clinic a call to make sure you're okay. They're going to ask you the screening question, because the idea is we would, if you're sick, manageably sick. If you're really sick, you should always come to the hospital. But if you're manageably sick, if you've got a little cough, if you've got a little cold, something that you can manage at home, we'd rather you just stay home.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Yes. We have to remember that many of the patients up there are in that demographic that this particular virus seems to be going after.
That's really what a lot of folks don't understand. And there's a lot of people who have been sort of defiant in, not following the guidelines from the CDC. But, at VA, we have to realize that the average age of a VA patient is 67, right? Mm-hmm. And that's right in the sweet spot for folks that are having negative outcomes when it comes to COVID-19. And so we want to make sure that our veterans are well cared for and protected from the virus, and also our staff. We can't have our staff getting sick because the staff needs to be here to take care of our veterans. So
right, yes.
you can see where we have to be really careful about who's coming into our building.
Okay. Well, that's just one VA, and I'm sure that all of the ones all around the country have very similar restrictions and requirements as well. So check.
We're all pretty much marching by the same orders, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So make sure you check with your local VA before you go up there and see what restrictions they might have for you or whoever gives you a ride up there. So let me back up here.
Let me just share with you, Dale, real quick.
Ahead.
Another way you can check in with us real quick is you can always go to our website. We have an operating status on our website. It's sort of a beige-ish, yellowish-looking box right at the top of the page, annarbor.va.gov.
Mm-hmm.
And you can click into that, and it'll give you everything that's going on right now in the facility. You can go right into our operating status. And another way to keep up with what we're doing, because we're able to post immediately, and so it's a very timely way to communicate, is through our Facebook page. So go to VA Ann Arbor on Facebook and like us there. That way you'll get those updates as they come in.
Okay. Well, Brian, thank you very much for giving us this information. It's really important. I want to remind our audience out there, make sure you wash your hands all the time. Stay away from large crowds of people. If you don't feel well, don't go out and mix with anybody.
Really, it's just the basic stuff that we always do in order to, you know, protect ourselves from getting sick, right? You wash your hands because that's, chances are, that's where a virus is going to go. It's going to end up on your hands, and then you're going to touch your face, and then you're going to get sick. So wash your hands. If you cough or sneeze, cough into your elbow. All those basic things that you always do when you think you might be around people that have a cold, right?
Yes, and for those of you out there that are taking all of the hand wipes and everything else from all of the stores within a 50-mile radius, could you leave a couple for the rest of us? I was at three grocery stores in the local Ann Arbor area today, nothing but empty shelves.
It's like that at one of the grocery stores I went to just this morning.
It's
the weekend. You know, they got hit pretty hard on Friday, and that's the weekend, and deliveries aren't coming in.
Well, anyway, so everybody take care of yourself, and thank you very much, Brian. And hopefully this too shall pass.
Yeah, it will.
Sure will. Thanks, Brian.
See ya.
All right, so that was Brian Hayes from the Ann Arbor VA, just letting you know that there are some restrictions as far as you going into the Ann Arbor VA facility. You can still go in the main way, but their hours are a little bit shorter, and they won't let you in to visit anybody. And if you're under 18, forget about it. So just remember that. Don't go up there and, you know, get too upset if they won't let you in for one reason or another. So we're going to take a quick break right now, and when we come back, our guest for today's program is Tom Satterley, and his book is titled All Secure, Special Operations Soldiers Fight to Survive on the Battlefront or the Battlefield and the Home Front. So we'll be right back after this short message. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
And we're back here on Veterans Radio. I don't know if that's the best song. I don't know if the Special Forces has a song. I couldn't find one in a short time I was looking. But anyway, we're back here on Veterans Radio, and our guest today is Tom Satterley, and he is authored a book titled All Secure, A Special Operations Soldier's Fight to Survive on the Battlefront and the Home Front. And I wanted to introduce Tom to our audience a little bit. I'm going to have to talk a little bit about your background here, Tom, for a second. Tom retired as a senior non-commissioned officer of the most elite and secretive special force units in the United States military. Command Sergeant Tom Satterley fought some of the country's most fearsome enemies over the course of 20 years and thousands of missions. He fought desperately for his life, rescued hostages, killed and captured terrorist leaders, and has seen his friends maimed and killed all around him. I want to welcome Tom Satterley to Veterans Radio. Tom, welcome.
Thank you, Dale. It's an honor to be on.
It's an honor to talk to you. I have to admit that this book was it was a disturbing read, let's put it that way, but it was also a really important story that I want our audience to think about getting out there. And it's a non-generational thing, because many of your missions weren't the same, obviously, but I knew a lot of special forces operators when I was in the service 50 years ago, and some of your stories sounded very similar to those that I had heard at that time. So let's go back to where this all began. Where did you grow up, and where are you from?
Yeah, I grew up in Indiana, like right in central Indiana, Columbus, Indiana, just south of Indianapolis. Small town, you know, lived on the outskirts of town near the cornfields, and nothing spectacular about where I grew up at all.
Isn't Columbus, Indiana, where all those architectural buildings are?
Wow, it is, yeah. I didn't think anybody else would know that. That and Cummins Engine Company. So that's about it there. Well, okay. Back in the day, it might be more now.
Yeah, it's a great place to visit if you're into any type of architecture. It's pretty fantastic, and the war memorial there is to cry for when you see that one. That's in the middle of the town square. But anyway, I digress, as unfortunately I do on a regular basis. All right, so we're from Central Indiana, and for some reason you decided to join the Army right out of school.
You know, I was going to Indiana University a little bit, and I was building houses as well. But my best friend joined the Army, and he was home towards the end of summer after going through basic and AIT on his way to Germany. And we were on our way to a John Cougar concert, and he talked me into joining the Army in less than an hour. And I surprised everybody with that move.
I am sure you did. So, I mean, how did he convince you to join the Army? What was his selling point?
You know, I was looking for something. I wasn't really happy. I was blowing all my parents' money at college, and I was building houses, and I liked it, but I didn't see, you know, a 50-year future in that. And he was just telling me how great it was. He got his life turned around in the course of 2 months, you know, and for someone
true.
At that age, everything seems amazing. But he had direction. He was going to Germany. He was going to live there for a bit. And I thought, what a great way to get out of town, get some skills, and then go back to college. And he was talking about the college money, too. So my main goal for joining the military was to get in for 4 years and get some college money and get out.
Mm-hmm. And so what attracted you to Special Forces?
Yeah, one day I was in Germany for 3 years myself, and our platoon sergeant was formerly a Hungarian sergeant. And he had access to different schools in Germany, so I ended up going to French Commando School with our platoon. We went to the Swiss March, and we went to platoon confidence training, which was put on by Special Forces soldiers and Bad Tolts. And then I won a slot to go to German Ranger School, so I had access to different types of training than the rest of the combat engineers mechanized were. You know, they were just, like I was, driving an APC around and working in the motor pool all the time, and it was really boring. And every time we went to those schools, It was exciting and kind of dangerous, and I learned so much more that I was interested in, and I started looking towards Special Forces and being a Green Beret.
So after your first 4 years, you re-upped.
I did. I couldn't get into the Green Berets right away, so I just re-enlisted to get jump school in Fort Bragg, and I knew that would take me to the heart of Special Operations. And that's when I started looking, and I got into Special Forces Assessment Selection, and then I made the qualification course, and then I was in language school, and a couple of guys approached me and said, hey, you should keep going and try out for the unit, you know, and I was like, oh, well, what is it? Tell me about it. And they told me about it, and it sounded even better, so I thought, why not keep climbing the ladder? You know, I'm on the corporate ladder in my world, and I'm just working my way to the top, and I figured as soon as I could do it, as healthy as I could and as young as I could, I didn't think there'd be a better time, so I just kept climbing and climbing and until I found myself there.
All right. Well, this is one of the secret things we can't tell people, but we're going to do it anyway. what is the unit? I had never heard of the unit.
That's a generic term for Delta Force that has just been, you know, gone around through time. I've heard it called so many different names that it's always so many different calls it something else, something secretive yet cool sounding. And they just always refer to it as the unit, but it was Delta Force, and it was pretty much the top in the Army that they had, and I figured, why not? So I set my goals on that and made it, and spent 20 years there before I retired.
Wow. So Delta Force is above the Green Berets? I wouldn't say above.
Well,
I don't want to say good.
I wouldn't have said that when I was a Green Beret.
Don't call us, folks.
I have to say that now.
Don't call us, folks. but, I mean, in the hierarchy of special operations, let's put it that way, maybe.
I'd say it's definitely a different job in the Green Berets. You know, you're out to train and teach and build nations. And, of course, in the last 15 years, everyone's become an assaulter. You know, there were so many people to go kick in doors and take out and arrest and detain. There was a cry for it, but even now everyone's going back to the legacy tasks of, you know, Green Berets, let's do some nation building. Let's do some Fed. And, oh, by the way, the unit, you get back to just what your niche is. So it was a different skill set, and it. You know, I was excited to go try out because it's basically you go around the world, you know, the recruiting was better. You know, here's our training area, it's picture the world. And I'm like, I love that. I want to go around the world and I want to do stuff. And so, you know, they get the brunt of the money and it's just a different job.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like in reading your book, and we're talking with Tom Saddle here, and his book is titled All Secure, and I won't give you the subtitle, and the All Secure comes into play later on in the interview. But so you worked in smaller groups, it sounded like, or smaller team missions, like, you know, in my mind, either like single ship insertions.
Right. Yeah. Our teams were about half the size of special forces teams, mm-hmm. and we were never full. So I was on 4-man team most of the time, 4 to 5-man team.
Okay.
And then you'd go out and work by yourself or work in as couples, you know. And then for combat, you know, we'd go out as a troop, you know, so you got maybe 15, 20 guys mm-hmm. at the max. So, you know, you're putting yourself out there a little bit more, a little bit more dangerous environments, but non-combat type stuff a lot that people don't even know about that, you know, I could never talk about. But there's something always going on, and that's what enticed me to do that, was always being doing something other than at a time of war.
Mm-hmm. So where were your first missions
that
you can talk about?
I did some work in South America before mm-hmm. my first combat mission, which was in Somalia in 1993. That was, I had been in the unit just under 2 years, really, when Somalia broke out. We were doing some small team stuff in South America, and then, you know, Somalia popped up. We came back and started training up for it and ended up going. By the end of that year in 93, you know, mid-year 93, we deployed over to Somalia. So that was my first combat mission, and it was a lot different than what people think combat's all about, for sure.
Right. I know you were... I don't want to say you were excited to see, I guess you were a little excited to see how you would perform in an actual life and death situation.
Yeah, absolutely. I was, you know, everybody wants to test their mettle. They want to see if what they've been trained to do, if they can do it in the real environment. And even though in pretty much all the special operations, you train as realistically as possible, mm-hmm. minus the actual bullets flying back at you. You know, everybody wants to test their mettle in the real thing. And, you know, I tell jokes a lot of times where I walk into a room and say, hey, who wants to go get in a firefight with me now? And anybody raises their hands, I push over here on the left. I don't want to talk to them anymore. I want to talk to people who don't want to get in a firefight with me because they've probably been in one, you know, mm-hmm. and they don't really want to go back, but they have the skills to go back and do it, you know. So I look for less of the excitement to get into a firefight these days.
I would think so. In fact, I think that line will come up later when we talk about your diagnosis at some point. Well, you know, we might as well just let our audience know that you were, you know, in the movie, or not, you weren't in the movie, but your character was in the movie Black Hawk Down, and you were in, I forgot how to say it, Mogadishu, right? And,
yes.
In Somalia, and in 93, and you were part of that rescue attempt.
Yeah, that was our sixth mission, our actual mission. The first five were like what you think combat would be. You know, you might shoot at somebody, they might shoot back, but it's, you know, kind of distant, it's scary, but everybody goes home and tells all the exciting stories of, did you see that, or can you believe this happened? You know, and as the missions progressed, sometimes the volume of fire increased a little bit, but it was still nothing like what happened on 3 October when we got called out for that mission. And everything was kind of going according to plan, other than the volume of fire was extremely high on infill. And it was overwhelming, and there was people getting injured. But it was still, there was still time to make jokes, you know, underneath your fear.
Mm-hmm.
And then right before exfil is when the first helicopter got shot down. And that's when I knew, as young as I was, I knew everything would change. I just knew we couldn't leave. We would have to go to that site and secure it, and that's what we did, and that's what started the whole 18-hour firefight of fighting our way to the crash site, fighting to survive the entire night, you know, disjointed and spread out in I don't know how many different houses, but, you know, our position, my team's position, was on the farthest north, the northwest of friendly lines, if you will,
mm-hmm.
right at the tip of the crash site. With anything north of us was bad, anything west of us was bad, and all the other teams are spread out down the street just behind us. And I had no idea where anybody was the entire night. And the house is just getting blown down around you with rock-propelled grenades and people creeping up on you. And thank goodness for the little birds. keeping everybody away as much as possible that night because everyone was running out of ammunition and water and food and medical supplies, and people were starting to slowly die. So it was one of those nights where everything in my life changed, along with what I think a lot of my other friends that night had happened as well.
I can believe that. If can you describe what the city was like a little bit? When I was reading, I was totally engrossed in the story when you were talking about, you know, trying to rappel off of a helicopter to the top of a building. To me, was just outrageous. And it was, you know, helicopters make a really big target.
I used to get down as fast as I could and then run away as far as I could because they're just bullet magnets. And when they're hovering there, and no matter how many people are on the line or on the rope, it is just they have to stay there. They can't move.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen on video now from Somalia where they've taken direct RPG hits to the rotor blades while people are on the ropes, and those pilots are so good. They're just sitting there hovering the whole time, you know, and making sure that they don't dip the nose or anything and shake people off of the fast rope. But, you know, you got the helicopter blowing all the dirt up in the air. You can't mm-hmm. see. It's in your mouth. It's in your eyes. And then people are shooting at you. And you're just hoping that the pilot maintains his calm, you know, and doesn't jerk that throttle mm-hmm. anything while you're going down that fast rope. But
right.
once you're on the ground, it just doesn't get any better. You know, you got people shooting at you. You got hoping the helicopter doesn't get shot down above you mm-hmm. and then fall on you. Because everybody knows that once that helicopter's down, it's a whole nother mission.
Right. And that was, you had trained for those types of missions as well, hadn't you?
We had just prior to that, they had shot down another helicopter. So General Garrison was like, we need to do some downed helicopter rehearsals. And so we actually practiced that a couple of times, and we would have been good with one helicopter. But when they shot down the second helicopter and had a second crash site, along with the convoy being lost and driving around town trying to find their way to us, everybody's getting shot and injured, and they're running out of people, and we just weren't prepared for something of that magnitude. Mm-hmm. We're just such a small element, which is a supporting element, that it's, you know, we're not prepared to stay longer than, you know, I would expect to be on target less than an hour in most places.
Mm-hmm.
And an hour to me would make me nervous. And right. and like in Iraq, we're going to Sadr City, and I'm like, okay, we're in and out in 20 minutes, or that's it, you know, mm-hmm. or we're leaving no matter what, because we don't have the manpower to fight off a larger force like that.
Wow. We are talking with Tom Satterley, he's the author of the book All Secure. It's about his adventures as a special operations soldier's fight to survive on the battlefield and the home front. And we're going to take a real quick break here, Tom. And when we come back, we're going to continue. I think we'll take you to Iraq next time, and then we'll get into your foundation and so forth, okay?
Perfect. Sounds great.
All right. Hold on for just a second. All right. We'll be back in just a moment. We're going to take a real quick break here, and you're listening to Veterans Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Specialist Ross McGinnis threw his back against the grenade thrown into his Humvee, saving the lives of his crewmates. Details after this. On December 4th, 2006, McGinnis was manning the turret in the last Humvee of a six-vehicle patrol in northeast Baghdad when an insurgent threw a grenade from the roof of a nearby building. As he stood up to get ready to jump out of the vehicle, as he'd been trained to do, officials say McGinnis realized the other four soldiers in the vehicle did not know where the grenade had landed and did not have enough time to escape. He threw his back against the radio mount and smothered the explosive with his body. McGinnis was killed instantly, while the other four men survived. He was awarded the Medal of Honor posthumously by President Bush on June 2nd, 2008. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Attention all World War II veterans. This is Dale Thronberry with Veterans Radio, and I want to make sure that you are aware of a special program being held at the American House in Dearborn Heights, Michigan on May 8th from noon till 3 o'clock. This is a celebration of the end of World War II, especially those that were in there for the end of the war in Europe. And we want to be there. We want you all to be there. So we need to get an RSVP from you. So please give us a call at 248-912-3237. That's 248-912-3237. Mark your calendars now. It's May 8th from noon to 3 at the American House in Dearborn Heights, Michigan. Any World War II veteran is welcome to this. We're going to be there with pictures. I believe they're going to have some awards and special items that they're going to be giving the World War II veterans. So if you know of a World War II veteran, please contact them. Please get them to call this number again. That's 248-912-3237. Thank you.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we are talking with Tom Satterley, whose book is titled All Secure, Special Operations Soldiers Fight to Survive on the Battlefield and the Home Front. We're just kind of finished up a story with Tom was talking about his adventures in Somalia when he was part of the Black Hawk Down story. And how do you survive things like that? I don't know. I mean, just it seemed to me the mental anguish that you must have gone through with losing, so many of your compatriots there.
Yeah, it's difficult. Surviving on target is a lot of luck. I used to think it was a lot of training and that gets you there, but there's a lot of luck involved too, and standing in the right place at the right time, because you never know who's shooting at you from where. So there's not a lot of dodging bullets. Dealing with life after that, with losing so many friends, was a long, difficult journey of a lot of self-pity, a lot of sadness, a lot of thinking in the wrong direction, living in misery, which none of my friends who died would ever want. You know, they would never want me living that way, and they wouldn't expect anybody living that way, yet, you know, you take that sadness and carry it for so long, and then someone else dies, and somebody else dies, and somebody else dies, or kills himself, or something, and starts stacking up, and it's, you know, you could get stuck in it, and I got stuck in it for a while, and I finally, you know, turned it around and decided to live the life that my friends would want me to live, that the life that I would hope that they would live had they survived as well.
Right. So it sounds a little bit like a little bit of survivor's guilt there, which I think we all have somewhat. And you know, you want to make sure that you live your life to the fullest, because they're not able to do it on their own.
Exactly.
Exactly.
You know, live a life that they'd be proud of, that you're proud of, that your kids and your spouse expects and deserves as well, versus, you know, suffering in silence and living miserable the rest of your life.
That is so true, Tom. So after you get out of Somalia, you come back here to the States for a number of years, and then you get to go to Iraq. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was a whole different world. You know, going to Somalia, I wasn't in charge of anything except myself, really. You know, I run around and break stuff and shoot at people and do my job. And now, fast forward to Iraq, I've moved up through the unit, and now I'm in charge. You know, I'm a troop sergeant major on my first trip. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm still running around with the guys and going out on targets. So you still get the exciting part, though more cautious, because now I'm in charge of other people's souls and their lives. And,
right.
And anything that I do wrong, you know, in the past, might have gotten me killed, might have gotten other people killed, but now my decisions affect a larger group of people. And so it was a lot more stressful on me. And, you can become one of two different leaders. You can lead with love or you can lead with fear.
Mm-hmm.
And for many years, I led with fear. I led with, you know, anger and aggression and violence. And I was fair. And everybody always tell you, oh, he was fair, but yeah, he was a jerk. You know, he was, straightforward. You know, there's other terms that they've used for me, but
yeah, we can't do that. Was on the radio, I know.
Right. And so I fully understood it, and now I've turned that all around to where instead I lead with love, you know, because it just, people will still do the things that you want for them, you know, but once you get to understand who's working for you and you get closer to them, versus I put my arm out trying not to get to know people because I never knew what would happen. And
yes,
I just had to keep a professional to keep my sanity, you know, going at the time, which took its toll on me more so than in Somalia. It wasn't as violent to me during the Iraq years. It wasn't that 18-hour firefight of I want to go home. It was it might happen tonight, it might happen tonight, you know, whether you do one hit or 10 hits a night for 90 days. It's that feeling of, yeah, it could happen, but not that constant stress of, I just wish I could get out of this firefight. But the leadership was very stressful for me and took its toll in a different way.
Right. You mentioned that you would do 10 hits a day. Could you tell our audience what a hit was?
Yeah, if we had a mission, and we might sit back at our house and plan to do three different missions that night, where we'd go take down three different people's houses or compounds, going after bad guys, and that could be going after suicide bomb makers or early on it was regime leaders who weren't as much of a threat,
mm-hmm.
you know, though they could have been. You get kind of used to that, and then later on you have the foreign fighters who are going to fight to the death. So every time you blow somebody's door open or kick in their door, you know they're going to be shooting back. And you can do one of those a night, or you can do 10 of those, or we could go out planning to do one, and somebody ends up finding information on target, or the person on target says something that takes you to another house or another house or another compound, which, you know, could lead to you do 5 or 6 that night when you're only planned on doing one, or you plan on doing 5 in a night while another group does another 5, and we'd call it the night of the long knives, where we'd go out and hit maybe 30 different targets in one night before they could call each other on their phones and warn each other,
mm-hmm.
so we could round up a whole terrorist cell or a whole foreign fighter, you know, platform. If we, you know,
mm-hmm.
The most people you can roll up at one time, the better, and it's stressful and it's more dangerous for us, but it's better than letting the bad guys get away via phone call or understanding or finding out that somebody got arrested or detained, and now they pack up and change their whole plan of operation.
Right. I mean, it's obviously it's much more complicated than it was 50 years ago, and with the technology and so forth, and that you went through part of that deck of cards, didn't you?
We did. Yeah, it was the deck of cards and the blacklist that they had. Yeah, we had our fair share. I was on the one with Saddam Hussein, so that was a good one. You know, the Ace of Spades is always a good one to put in your deck, throw that in your resume. But that was, the night before I took my troop out, and we captured the person that was hiding Saddam Hussein. And we'd done that for a while. So that night, you know, when I got woken up the next morning after the hit saying, hey, we have another hit, this guy knows where Saddam is. Of course, I don't really believe it much, you know. It happened so many times.
Sure.
As we continued to plan and get more information, I thought, okay, this sounds more and more real. And then packed it up, did the hits in Tikrit, and then finally got back to the house and saw him sitting there in the chair. I was like, wow. You know, you have that temporary feeling of, wow, this is over.
Right.
But then you also have that feeling of, okay, well, who's next? Because I just have to go back to work tomorrow and do the same thing I did today, no matter who you capture. It's always just get up and do it again anyway.
Right. Yeah. I think I probably felt that way when Ho Chi Minh died when I was in Vietnam. I said, oh, it's over.
Right.
Not
everybody
quite.
Gets to go home now.
Send everybody home. Well, finally, you were able to come home, and you retired. So you spent, what, 25 years in the service in total?
Yep. Just at 25.
And a lot of things didn't go quite the way you wanted them to when you got out.
No, you know, I everything obviously my own fault. I didn't plan ahead, which is what we tell a lot of people now with our foundation, and mm-hmm. I didn't really consider, you know, retirement's retirement. We're going fishing, we're going to relax and do nothing, you know. But number one, on a retirement salary, you're not going to do that. And then number two, after spending 20 years doing such exciting things that I had done, I don't see how fishing can ever even equate to that. So you have to learn to change your whole mentality and your whole mindset on what you're looking for in life, or you're never going to be happy. And it took me a good, wow, almost probably six to seven years to figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
So I had 5 to 6, 7 years of dark times where I was just lying to myself and reclusing and drinking heavily. And I was on so many different medications that they had prescribed to me, and I started abusing my medications. And it was just one of those things where you fall in the hole slowly, and you don't even know you're falling in the hole. And, you know, in the whole way, I'm telling people to, you know, I had zero empathy. So if you had something wrong with you, I didn't care. You know, fix it. That's what we do. We fix things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We fix problems. And I didn't realize I couldn't fix myself. I wasn't even focusing on myself. And it was a dark period for me.
I've talked to a number of special forces, either Navy SEALs or, you know, Green Berets or Delta Force and all that other things. And most of them, when they got out, they had that same difficulty. And I think probably anybody that you've talked to that's been in combat, when you first get out of the service, you don't know what to do with your energy and your adrenaline and all these other things. And you do silly things that you would never contemplate if you were sane, I guess would be the word I would use for that one.
Exactly. Yeah, I've had so many friends that have died doing dangerous sports, you know, parasailing behind cars or base jumping off of radio antenna towers in the dark at night, you know, and I'm like, wow, they're just chasing that feeling, I guess.
I guess so. I mean, everybody had to have a motorcycle, you had to have a muscle car, you had to have, you know, all the other different things that, you know, to try and keep that going. And you did some bodyguard work and some security work, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. And we did a lot of training too. So I was always, I actually lived in Amman, Jordan for almost two years when I got out. I was training the Jordanian military to be special forces qualified, doing a job for Prince Hashim. And I was doing sort of okay while I was doing that. It's almost like still being in the military. I hired, you know, 10 other special forces qualified guys to help me teach this course. It was great running it, being in charge and having a good time. But when that dried up, there was nothing, and it just all came crashing down. Like, what do I do? I don't belong to anything. I'm not contributing to anything. And it just instantly, you feel like you're nobody. And then your self-worth drops. And then you feel like, well, what do I have to offer this world? Maybe my time is up. Maybe I'm done what I came to do. And so I figured I'd run out of missions. And, I got to the point where I wanted to kill myself and almost did. And that's when my life started to turn around, you know, thanks to my wife.
I was going to say, tell me about Jen.
Yeah, she's the star of my book. I mean, she's the hero.
And she is.
She's the one that she helps people every day. I mean, when she pulled me out of the hole and it was so easy, I realized it just took somebody just to listen and show me some compassion and empathy and not judge. And she didn't understand anything about the military until she met me, had nothing to do with it, would never want to do anything with the military. And then we worked together, and during our training, she got to talk to, you know, Green Berets and Navy SEALs and Rangers and started to understand what
you were
was
making,
common.
You were making training films and things, weren't you, at that time?
Yeah, we co-founded a organization that did the training, and she did all of the film and photography so they could use it for after-action reports to review their hits and get better at it. And she became the den mom for everybody around. They were just talking to her, and the commonality was, I want help at home. I need help at home. I need help with my relationship. I don't know how to have a relationship with my spouse or my children anymore, and I don't know what to do, and why am I so angry? And she's like, that's exactly what Tom's problem is, and it was throughout the board with everyone, how to feel like you can contribute, feel part of something again, and, oh, by the way, help me in my relationship because I'm so used to being gone all the time, and now I'm home. I don't know how to do this job.
Mm-hmm.
So she looks at me one day, and she's like, we have to start a foundation. I'm like, what are you talking about? I have no idea what you're talking about. And she's like, well, you know, you were in Delta Force, and I've got a background in this, you know, marketing and stuff. We can do anything. And I'm like, okay, sure. Let's try that. And she goes, oh, by the way, you need to write a book. I was like, that's never happening, ever. And she's like, well, we'll talk about that later. And, of course, you know who won that one.
Yes, well, that's
she's such a compassionate, empathetic person that just understands. And she's on the phone every day of the week, always talking to a spouse or a veteran and finding the right place for them, you know. And I'm on the phone talking to veterans and we're looking at each other like, okay, what's next? And pick up the phone, and there's the next person on the line. So we started doing couples retreats to help as a part of our foundation to bring, you know, the couples back together, help them look at those triggers of PTS and how to reconnect as a family again. And it's been very helpful for us to do it and cathartic, and it's helpful for all the people that we've helped along the way.
I noticed you just used the term PTS. You've dropped the D, which is something that we say here on Veterans Radio all the time. Some people suffer from PTS and just drop the D. And
yeah, nobody, that's a turnoff for everyone. They don't like
absolutely
the word disorder, so they don't call you. And I mean, I my closest friends I just got off the phone today with, I don't want to bother you. I don't want to bother you, you know. And I'm like, bother me. That's what I do for a living now, man. And by the way, you're my friend. So please, you know, call me. And it's just people hear the word disorder and they're embarrassed. And it's already hard enough to pull these stories out. Mm-hmm. When people call me, half the time they just start crying because they can't believe they've done it. And I'm like, hey, go ahead. Whenever you're ready, we'll start talking, you know. Mm-hmm. And once we get past that hurdle, it's like, wow, what flows out of everyone's mouth is always so similar. And they just want to know that they're loved. And every human wants to be connected. Mm-hmm. Every human wants to feel connected and protected. And when we don't feel connected, we divert to protection. So that's why we argue with our spouses so much. You know, if we don't feel connected with them, then we argue to protect ourselves. And it's, once we understand that, and we tell the veterans, and we do active duty now too, that there's not a disorder. We're not doing therapy. We're retraining you. Just like you didn't know how to shoot a weapon when you got in, and they trained you to shoot it. Now you're good at it. We're going to train you how to be a better person, how to be the person you were before all these bad things happened to you and that you witnessed and saw and were part of.
Mm-hmm. Well, what we're talking about right now with Tom Satterlee is his foundation called All Secure. And tell us how your branding expert came up with that name.
Yeah, my wife asked me, what is a term that you guys use in the unit that would go along with feeling good, feeling better? And I gave it some thought, and I thought, you know what? The most dangerous time is when you're on target. And when the target is finally taken down and all the bad guys are either dead or detained, everyone calls in all secure from their different sections, and that's when you pass to hire. We're all secure, meaning everybody can let their guard down just a little bit, mm-hmm. breathe easier, and start to do business as usual. And I thought, that's perfect. You're getting out of the military or you're in the military and you have this enormous pressure on you and you don't know what's bothering you. You don't know what's going on. You can't tell anybody about it because you think they'll take away your clearance or you think you'll be considered weak. Why not feel all secure? You know, that mm-hmm. what a perfect moment to just let your guard down and say, you know what, I could use a little help. I just need someone to stand by me and give me some support right now. And so that's how we kind of came up with that.
It's called the All Secure Foundation. It's allsecurefoundation.org. And it sounds very similar. There's so many great organizations out there now that want to help veterans and their families and their caregivers, which is, you know, without our caregivers, where would we be, right?
Right.
All of us. And so you started this up with your wife, and you've gone through some other different, more non-traditional therapies, I guess you could say, or treatments. Could you describe a couple of those?
Yeah,
what's been most effective for you?
Everything that I could so far. I've done TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation, where, you know, they used to shock you, put a board in your mouth and shock you, but mm-hmm. now they have, you know, it's just magnetic waves that they put through your brain, and when they connect, you know, that's kind of similar to electric shock. And I went through 12 weeks of that. It was about 20 minutes a day, 5 days a week for 12 weeks. And that was such an amazing instant turnaround for me of less depression, less aggressiveness, less of my OCD behaviors. I've got to clean it. Everything's got to be perfect. Mm-hmm. And I really, really calmed down a lot with that. But I didn't stop with that. We do emotionally focused therapy as well with our counselor, who we ended up hiring for our foundation. She was so good. Because I'd gone through five different therapists before that when I found her and we were with her for a year, I realized how much good she had done for me that we had to, you know, we had to make her an offer to come on board and help mm-hmm. us bring this to other veterans. And she's working with us to do the online content that we're working on this year now as well. But, and then I mean, I've done things like acupuncture and yoga and cupping and anything. I'm willing to try anything. And whenever I hear of another therapy, I let it kind of play out for a little bit and see, mm-hmm. get past the hype of it. And then I start talking to other veterans who have gone through it. And if I get, you know, like a good 80, 90% solution that it worked for people, I'll go try that. And there's a couple more that I want to do, like the ganglion block injection. And then they've got bone marrow stuff, you know, to help with the pain that I'm always in. But I don't think it works for the back right now, so I'm kind of holding off. But, you know, I tell people, I've gone to a therapist, it didn't work, so I quit. I'm like, well, what in life ever worked the first time? And if you quit every time, you never get anywhere. So I tell mm-hmm. people, go to another therapist. Find one that works for you. Just, they're humans, too, so you got to find what works and then stick with that. And not quit every time something, you know, bad happens or every time you fail.
Tell me a little bit about part of your All Secure Foundation is subtitled Virago, What is that?
My wife decided to start for the female spouses of special operations, even though they're mostly female spouses now. She wanted just a space for females who are either active duty still or out, where they can go and connect on a social platform and ask for help. And she's actually in the process of writing a book where she just got a couple of book offers. Now she's trying to make a decision on that will be like mine, to where I don't think the title will be Virago, but it is kind of like All Secure was. It'll help women with all the different things that she's gone through, what's worked for her, places to go for resources, and just stories. But the social platform Virago and the website for that is to help the females a safe place to go and talk, to where their husbands either won't know about it or their husbands' units won't know about it.
Okay.
Because we get so many private phone calls and messages. I love what you're doing, but I can't comment or I can't, you know, chime in because my husband might see it or his friends might see it. And everyone has that stigma of, oh, there's something wrong with the family. That means you might not be as ready, you know. And what we're telling them is, like, you go to the gym to work out, to get stronger, to be more limber. It's the same thing with mental health. But as soon as you say mental health, people think mental disorder instead of, it's exercising for your brain. It's giving you more tools to be a stronger soldier holistically, you know, all the way through, versus just physically strong and you're highly trained, yet mentally you're sad and you're suffering, but you're hiding it. You know, you could be a stronger soldier while you're in. It doesn't mean you're weak. It means you're stronger for being, you know, being able to ask for help to be better.
Right. In fact, you mentioned that throughout the book. We're talking with Tom Satterley here, and his book is All Secure. I didn't mention the co-author, Steve Jackson. I want to make sure I get his name in there. I'm sure you do, too. But you mentioned throughout the book that any time you felt any sense of weakness, that somebody else might be able to find it and you'd be out.
Yeah, that was a fear we all had. You know, we had therapists at the unit, you know, and everyone knows everyone is at the unit for the command, right? To protect the unit, protect the man, not the individual. So everyone thinks, well, if I go talk to the therapist about something I'm having, you know, I would go talk to him about family problems or anything like that all day long. But to go say, hey, I'm really disturbed about losing so many friends recently, or I'm thinking about that mission we went on, it kind of disturbing me or whatever I had to do. You know, nobody wants to go do that because it's saying that, hey, the job I'm doing, I can't handle. And nobody wants to say that, but you can say, hey, the job I'm doing affects me. I want to work on that so I can be stronger and be able to do my job, you know, into the future. It's just kind of changing the way people look at it, changing the culture. And we've been changing the verbiage, you know, like you said, we don't say disorder. Sometimes we call it occupational stress injury or just retraining, you know, hey, let's retrain that muscle memory that you have to be angry all the time. Let's retrain that muscle memory for you to be happy more often. And that's what's worked for me was focusing more on good things instead of bad. And, you know, cause I found out that if you're looking for it, you'll find it. If I'm looking for a negative in the world, I'll find it. If I'm looking for positive and happiness, that's what I find.
Well, you've been on a great journey and it hasn't ended yet. I'm really excited to hear more about what's going on with the All Secure Foundation. Again, for our audience, that's allsecurefoundation.org. I really strongly suggest that you go and check it out. There's a lot of great information and resources on there. And you can even buy a book there, which I think that you will. I think they would enjoy it in one way, but it really tells the story of what special operations soldiers go through for their career. I have a relative who was a Ranger and worked with the Navy SEALs and everything, and I was reading the book and I kept seeing him in the book. You know, there were similarities that were all over the place. And Tom, I want to thank you very much. When Jen writes her book, please let me know about it. I would love to have her on and talk about that. I think that's an important story as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think she's looking to have it out by the end of the year. So.
Okay. All right. Well, feel free. I'd love to have you back on the program when if anything that's going on with the All Secure Foundation, just let me know and we'll have you back on.
All right. Thank you so much. And I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Bye. All right. That was Tom Satterley. His book is All Secure. It's a special operations soldier's fight to survive on the battlefield and the home front. It's a really exciting read. It's a hard read. There's some humorous things in there. There's some very sad things in there. I mean, it's a great story, and I encourage you to find the book. It's out there on Amazon. But if you go through the All Secure Foundation, then they get a little bit more of the pie, as they say. So I want to make sure that you do that. I want to go back and talk just a little bit about the upcoming event for World War II veterans. And I want to make sure that anybody out there who knows of a World War II veteran, we can get them to come out to this. It's the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II. It's on May 8th. It's at the American House in Dearborn Heights, Michigan. And it goes from 12 to 3, I believe, is the time period. It's going to be pictures taken and all kinds of different things going on there. And we'll be out there interviewing World War II veterans as well. And so if you could please give them a call to let them know that you're going to be able to try and make it. That number is 248-912-3237. That's 248-912-3237. I also want to make sure that you go to our website, veteransradio.net, and sign up to win that jacket, the A2 leather jacket from U.S. Wings. You can go to uswings.com, and there's a picture of it on there. And then finally, let's see, what do we got? We're at the end of our program. If you have any comments about today's program, go to veteransradio.net. You can leave your comments there and get the jacket. And I also want to make sure that you're aware that Veterans Radio is now part of the Veterans Radio America network, and it is a nonprofit organization, so now you can deduct your donation. So we encourage you to go to our website, veteransradio.net, and do that. And until next week, this is a production of Veterans Radio America, and you are dismissed.